replied immediately. "He's one of the forest people." The Janoskwa's growl might have gotten a little louder. It was so deep that I had a hard time knowing for sure. "What's the difference?" Asher asked. "I once saw one of the forest people take on about 20 ghouls in a fair fight," I said. "It wasn't even close. If he'd been playing for keeps, none of them would have survived." The Janoskwa snorted a breath out through his nose. The sound was simply vile with rage, with broiled, congealed hate. I held out both of my hands, palms up. I had rarely seen the kind of power that River Shoulders, the forest person I'd met several times before, had displayed, physically and otherwise, and it seemed like a really fantastic idea to mend some fences, if possible. "Sorry about what I said earlier. I figured Nicodemus had a troll stashed around here or something. Didn't realize it was one of the forest people. I've done a little business with River Shoulders in the past. Maybe you've heard of..." I don't even know what happened. I assume the Janoskwa closed the distance and hit me. One minute I was trying to establish some kind of rapport, and the next I was about a dozen feet in the air, flying across the factory floor, tumbling. I saw the conference table, the windows, the ceiling, and Jordan's incredulous face staring down at me from a catwalk. And then I hit the brick wall, and light briefly filled my skull. I mean, I didn't even notice when I fell and hit the floor, or maybe I just can't remember that part. I do remember that I came up fighting. The Janoskwa walked over the conference table, he just stepped over it, and covered the distance to me in cat-like silence in three great strides, moving as lightly as a dancer despite the fact that he had to weigh in at well over 800 pounds. I threw a blast of winter at him, only to see him make a contemptuous gesture and spit a slavering, snarling word. The ice that should have entombed him just drained away into the floor beneath him, grounding out my magic as effectively as a lightning rod diverts the power of a thunderbolt. I had about half of a second to realize that my best shot had bounced off him with somewhat less effect than I would have had if I'd slugged him with a foam rubber pillow. And then he hit me again. Aerial cartwheels. Another flash of impact against a wall. Before I could fall, he had closed the distance again, and his enormous hands drove a rusty old nail into my left pectoral muscle. Once the steel nail had broken the surface of my skin, my contact with the mantle of the winter night shattered, and I was just plain old vanilla me again. And that meant pain. A whole lot of pain. The mantle had suppressed the pain of my broken arm, among other things, but once it was taken out of the circuit, all of that agony came rushing into my brain at the same time, an overload of torturous sensation. I screamed and thrashed, grabbing at the Janoskwa's wrist with both hands, trying to force his arm and the nail he still held away from me. I might as well have been trying to push over a building. I couldn't so much as make him acknowledge my effort with a wobble, much less move him. He leaned down, huge and gray and horrible smelling, and pushed his ugly mug right up into mine, breathing hard through his mouth. His breath smelled like blood and rotten meat. His voice came out in a surprisingly smooth, mellow basso. "Consider this a friendly warning," he said, his accent harsh, somehow bitter. "I am not one of the whimpering forest people. Speak of me and that flower-chewing groundhog-lover River Shoulders in the same breath again, and I will devour your offal while you watch." I said. The room was spinning like some kind of wacky animated drunk scene. The nail evidently robbed some of the power of Mab's earring, too. Someone drove a railroad spike into each temple, and I suddenly couldn't breathe. The Janoskwa stepped back from me abruptly, as though I was something unworthy of his attention. He faced the rest of the room while I clawed desperately at the nail sticking out of my chest. "You," he said to the people seated at the table, "do what Nicodemus says when he says, or I will twist off your head." He flexed his huge hands, and I suddenly noticed that they were tipped in ugly-looking, dirty claws. "Been here most of 2 days, and none of you ever saw me. followed some of you all over this town last night. None of you saw me. You don't do your job now, no place you run will keep you from me." Those at the table stared at him, stunned and silent, and I realized that my plan for stealing Nicodemus's thunder and destabilizing his authority over the crew had just gone down in flames. The Janosqua was apparently satisfied with his entrance. He strode to the pen and, as if it had been an appetizer at a sports bar and not a nimble animal trying desperately to avoid its fate, he plucked up a goat, broke its neck using only one hand, and vanished again, gone more suddenly than he had appeared. Karen was at my side a second later, grabbing the nail with her small, strong hands, but the pain was just too damn much. I was fading. "Well," I dimly heard Nicodemus say, "that's dinner. Going, gone." Chapter 23. I hadn't been to this place in a very long time. It was a flat, empty floor in some vast, open, and unlit space that nonetheless somehow didn't echo with its emptiness, as if there were no walls from which sounds could reflect. I stood in a circle of light, though I couldn't quite make out the source of illumination above me. It was the first time, though, that I'd ever been standing there alone. "Hey!" I called out into the empty space. "It's not like my own subconscious can up and disappear, you know. If you've got something you want to say, hurry it up. I'm busy." "Yeah, yeah," called a voice from the darkness. "I'm coming. Keep your pants on." There were shuffling footsteps, and then I appeared. Well, it wasn't me, exactly. It was my double, though, a mental image of myself that had appeared a few times in the past, and that I would probably avoid mentioning to any mental health professionals who had signed mandatory reporting clauses. Call him my subconscious, my id, the voice of my inner jerk face, whatever. He was a part of me that didn't surface much. He was dressed in black, a tailored black shirt, black pants, expensive black shoes. He had a goatee, too. Look, I never said my inner self was hideously complex. In addition to his usual outfit, he also wore a pin on his left breast, a snowflake, wrought from silver with such complexity and detail that one could see the crystalline shapes of its surface. Whoa. I wasn't sure exactly what the hell that meant, but given how my day was going, I was reasonably sure it was nothing good. There was someone with him. It was a smallish figure, covered in what looked like a black blanket of soft wool. It moved slowly, hunched as if in terrible pain, leaning hard against my double's supporting arms. I said, "What?" My double sneered at me. "Why is it that you've never got the least goddamn clue what's happening inside your own head? Have you ever noticed this trend? Doesn't it bug you sometimes?" "I try not to overthink it," I said. He snorted. "Hell's bells, that's true. We have to talk." "Why can't you just send dreams like everyone else's subconscious?" "I've been trying," he said, and shifted into a voice that sounded suspiciously like Bullwinkle, the cartoon moose.
"But somebody's been busy not overthinking it."
I arched an eyebrow. "Oh, wait, that dream with Murphy, that was you?" "All the dreams are me, blockhead," my double said. "And I swear, dude, you've got to be the most repressed human being on the face of the planet." "What? Maybe you didn't notice, but I'm not exactly bending over backwards for anybody." "Not oppressed, moron, repressed, as in sexually. What is wrong with you?" I blinked, offended. "What?" "You were doing okay with Susan," he said, "and Anastasia. Wow, there's really something to be said for experience." I felt myself blushing and reminded myself that I was talking to me. "So? And what about all the things you've missed, dummy?" he asked. "You had the shadow of a freaking angel who could have shown you any sensual experience you could possibly have imagined, but did you take her up on it? No. Mab's been throwing girls at you. You could literally make one phone call and have half a dozen supernaturally hot she-girls playing rodeo with you anytime you wanted, and instead, you're playing hopscotch over the cages of has-been demons. Hell, Hannah Asher would have gotten busy with you if you wanted.
It's parkour, I said defensively. And just because I don't go to bed with everything with a vagina doesn't mean I'm repressed. I don't want it to be just sex.
Why not? My double said, exasperated. Go forth and freaking multiply. Drink from the cup of life. Carpe fem. For the love of God, get laid.
I sighed. Right. Id me didn't have to be concerned with long-term consequences. He was my instinctive, primitive self, driven by my most primal impulses. I wondered briefly if id and idiot came from the same root.
You wouldn't get it, I said. It's got to be more than just physical attraction. There's got to be respect and affection.
Sure, he said, his tone absolutely acidic. Then how come you haven't banged Murphy yet?
Because, I said, growing flustered, we haven't gotten to, there's been a lot, look, fuck off.
Ha, my double said. You're obviously terrified of getting close to someone, afraid you'll get hurt and rejected. Again.
No, I'm not, I said.
Oh, please, he said. I've got a direct line to your hindbrain. I've got your fears on Blu-ray. He rolled his eyes. Like she isn't feeling exactly the same thing.
Murphy isn't afraid of anything, I said.
Two ex-husbands, and the last one married her little sister. He might as well have sent her a card that said, I'd like you, only you're too successful, and old. And you're a freaking wizard who's going to live for centuries. Of course she's freaking out about the idea of getting involved with you.
I frowned at that.
You really think so?
No, dolt. You really think so.
I snorted. Okay, guy, if you're so smart, what do?
If having something real is so important to you, man up and go get her, my id said. You could both be dead tomorrow. You're heading for the realm of freaking death, for crying out loud. What the hell are you waiting for?
I said. Let me answer that for you, I said. Molly. I blinked.
No. Molly's a freaking kid.
She was a freaking kid, my double said. She's heading for her late 20s, in case you forgot how to count. She's not all that much younger than you, and the proportional distance is only shrinking. And you like her, and you trust her, and the two of you have a ton in common. Go get laid there.
Dude, no, I said. That is not going to happen.
Why not?
It would be a serious violation of trust.
Because she's your apprentice? He asked.
No, she isn't. Not anymore. Hell's bells, man. She's practically your boss when you get right down to it. At the very least, she got promoted past you.
I'm not having this conversation, I said. Repression and denial, my double said acerbically. Get thee to a therapist.
The figure next to him made a soft sound.
Right, the double said. We don't have much time. Murphy's pulling the nail out.
Time for what? I asked. And who is that?
Seriously? He asked. You aren't going to use your intuition even a little, huh?
I scowled at him, and at the other figure, and then my eyes widened.
Wait, is that the parasite?
The shrouded figure shuddered and let out a pained groan.
No, my double said. It's the being that Mab and that stupid Alfred have been calling a parasite.
I blinked several times.
What?
Look, man, my double said, you've got to work this out. Think, okay? I can't just talk to you. This near-dream stuff is my best, but you've got to meet me halfway.
I narrowed my eyes.
Wait, you're saying that the parasite isn't actually a parasite? But that means...
The wheel is turning, my double said, in the tone of a reporter covering a sports event. The fat, lazy old hamster looks like he's almost forgotten how to make it go, but he's sort of moving it now. Bits of rust are falling off. The cobwebs are slowly parting.
Screw you, I said, annoyed. It's not like you've showed up with a ton to say ever since... I trailed off and fell entirely silent for a long moment. Ah, he said, and pointed a finger at me, bouncing up onto his toes. Ah-ha! 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 The light begins to dawn! Ever since I touched Lashiel's coin, I breathed quietly. Follow that, my double urged me. What happened next? Touching the coin put an imprint of Lashiel in my head, I said. Like a footprint in clay, the same shape as the original. She tried to tempt me into accepting the true Lashiel into my head along with her, but I turned her down. My double rolled his wrist in a keep-it-moving gesture. And then the imprint started to change, I said. Lashiel was immutable, but the imprint was made of me, a shape in the clay. As the clay changed, so did the imprint. And I gave her a name, I said. I called her Lash. She became an independent psychic entity in her own right. And we kind of got along until... I swallowed. Until there was a psychic attack, a bad one. She threw herself in the way of it. It destroyed her. Yeah, my double said quietly. But, look, what she did was an act of love. And you were about as intimate with her as it gets, sharing the same mental space. I mean, it's funny, you get twitchy when you start considering living with a woman, but having one literally inside your head was not an issue. What do you mean? Christ, you're supposed to be the intellect here, my double said. Think! He stared at me for a long moment, visibly willing me to understand. My stomach fell into some unimaginable abyss at the same time my jaw dropped open. No, I said. That's not possible. When a mommy and a daddy love each other very much, my double said as if speaking to a small child, and they live together and hug and kiss and get intimate with each other, I felt a little ill. You're saying I'm pregnant? My double threw up his arms. Finally, he gets it! In years and years and years of experience as a wizard, I dealt with concepts, formulae, and mental models that ranged from bizarre to downright insanity-inducing. None of them had, in any way whatsoever, ever prepared my head to wrap around this. At all. Ever. How is that... That isn't even... What the hell, man? I demanded. A spiritual entity, my double said calmly. Born of you and Lash. When she sacrificed herself for you, it was an act of selfless love. And love is fundamentally a force of creation. It stands to reason, then, that an act of love is fundamentally an act of creation. You remember it, right? After she died? When you could still play the music she'd given to you, even though she was gone? You could hear the echoes of her voice? Yeah, I said, feeling dazed. That was because a part of her remained, my double said, made of her and made of you. And very gently, he drew back the black blanket. She looked like a child, maybe 12 years old, in the last few weeks of true childhood before the sudden surge of hormones brought on the chain of rapid changes that lead into adolescence. Her hair was dark, like mine, but her eyes were a crystalline blue-green, the way lashes had often appeared. Her features were faintly familiar, and I realized in a surge of instinct that her face had been constructed from those of people in my life. She had the square, balanced chin of Karen Murphy, the rounded cheeks of Ivy the Archive, and Susan Rodriguez's jawline. Her nose had come from my first love, Elaine Mallory, her hair for my first apprentice, Kim Delaney. I knew because they were my memories, right there in front of me. Her eyes were fluttering uncertainly, and she was shivering so hard that she could barely stand. There was frost forming on her eyelashes, and even as I watched, it started spreading over her cheeks. She's a spiritual entity, I breathed. Oh my God, she's a spirit of intellect. What happens when mortals get it on with spirits, my double confirmed, though now without heat. But Mab said she was a parasite, I said. A lot of people make jokes, refer to fetuses like that, he said. Mab called her a monster, said she would hurt those closest to me. She's a spirit of intellect, just like Bob, my double said. Born of the spirit of a fallen freaking angel and the mind of one of the most potent wizards on the White Council. She's going to be born with knowledge and with power and be absolutely innocent of what to do with them. A lot of people would call that monstrous. Oh, I said, and clutched at my head. I got it now. Mab hadn't been lying, not precisely. Hell, she'd as much as told me that the parasite was made of my essence, my soul, my me-ness. Spirits of intellect had to grow, and my head was a limited space. This one had been filling it up for years, slowly expanding, putting more psychic and psychological pressure on me, reflected in the growing intensity of my migraines over that time. If I'd realized what was happening, I could have done something sooner, and probably a lot more simply. Now, I was overdue, and it was looking like this was going to be a very, very rough delivery. And if I didn't have help, I'd be in much the same shape as a woman giving birth alone and encountering complications. Odds were good that my head wouldn't be able to stand the pressure of such a being abruptly parting ways with me, fighting its way out of a space that had become too small in sheer instinct for its own survival. It could drive me insane, or kill me outright. If that happened, it would leave the newly born spirit of intellect alone and bewildered in a world it didn't understand, but about which it had lots and lots of data. Spirits like Bob liked to pretend they were all about rationality, but they had emotions, attachments. The new spirit would want to connect, and it would try to do so with the people who mattered most to me. I shuddered, imagining little Maggie suddenly gaining a very, very seriously dangerous imaginary friend. See? I demanded of my double. You see? This is why you don't go around having sex with everyone all the time. You're the brain, he said. Figure it out. The lights flickered, and he looked up and around. Ugh, he said. Nails coming out. He was right. I could feel a faint pang in my chest and a fading echo of the agony in my head. Frost continued covering the little girl, and she sighed, her knees buckling. My double and I both stooped down and caught her before she could fall. I picked her up. She didn't weigh anything. She didn't look dangerous. She just looked like a little girl. Her eyes fluttered open.
I'm sorry, she stammered. Sorry. But it hurts, and I couldn't talk to you.
I traded a look with my double and then looked down at her. It's okay, I said. It's okay. I'm going to take care of it. It'll be all right. She sighed slightly and her eyes closed. Frost covered her in fine layers upon layers as the spell on Mab's earring wrapped her in sleep and silence, stilling her for now, and turning her into a beautiful white statue. I hadn't even known she was there, and she was entirely my responsibility. And if I didn't handle it, she would kill me being born. I passed her carefully to my double. Okay, I said. I've got it. He took her very gently and gave me a nod. I know she's weird, but she's still your offspring. His dark eyes flashed. Protect the offspring. Primal drives indeed. I'd torn apart a nation protecting my physical child. I was looking at part of the reason why. That drive was a part of me too. I took a deep breath and nodded to him. I'm on it, I said. He wrapped the girl in a blanket and turned to carry her back into the darkness. He took the light with him, and darkness swallowed me again. Hey! My double called abruptly from the distance. What? Don't forget the dream, he said. Don't forget how it ended. What is that supposed to mean? I asked. You flippin' idiot! My double snarled. And then he was gone, along with everything else. Chapter 24. I opened my eyes and saw the ceiling of Karen's bedroom. It was dark. I was lying down. Light from the hallway came creeping under the bedroom door and was almost too bright for my eyes.
"That's what I'm trying to tell you," Butters's voice was saying. "I don't know. There's no AMA-approved baseline for a freaking wizard night of winter. He could be in shock, he could be bleeding from the brain, he could be really, really sleepy. Damn it, Karen, this is what hospitals and practicing physicians are for."
I heard Karen blow out a breath.
"Okay," she said, without any kind of heat. "What can you tell me?"
"His arm's broken," Butters said, "from the swelling and bruising, badly.
Whatever put that dent in the aluminum brace on it, did he get it taken care of in a tool shop?"
"Rebroke it. I set it again, I think, and wrapped it up in the brace again. But I can't be sure I did it right without imaging equipment, which would probably explode if he walked into the room with it.
If it hasn't been set right, that arm might be permanently damaged."
He blew out a breath.
"The hole in his chest wasn't traumatic by his usual standards. It didn't go through the muscle, but the damn nail was rusty, so I hope he's had his tetanus shots. I gave the hole another stitch, and I washed the blood off the nail."
"Thank you," Karen said.
Butters's voice was weary.
"Yeah," he sighed. "Sure. Karen, can I tell you something?"
"What?"
"This thing he's got going with Mab," Butters said. "I know that everyone thinks it's turned him into some kind of superhero, but I don't think that's right."
"I've seen him move," she said. "I've seen how strong he is."
"So have I," Butters said. "Look, the human body is a pretty amazing machine. It really is. It can do really amazing things, much more so than most people think, because it's also built to protect itself."
"What do you mean?" she asked.
"Inhibitors," Butters said. "Every person walking around is about 3 times stronger than they think they are. I mean, your average housewife is actually about as strong as a fairly serious weightlifter when it comes to pure mechanics. Adrenaline can amp that even more."
I could hear the frown in Karen's voice.
"You're talking about when mothers lift cars off their kid, that kind of thing."
"Exactly that kind of thing," Butters said.
"But the body can't function that way all the time, or it will tear itself apart. That's what inhibitors are built for, to keep you from injuring yourself."
"What does that have to do with Dresden?"
"I think that what this winter night gig has done for him is nothing more than switching off those inhibitors," Butters said. "He hasn't added all that much muscle mass. It's the only thing that makes sense. The body is capable of those moments of startling strength, but they're meant to be something that you pull out of the hat once or twice in a lifetime. And with no inhibitors and no ability to feel pain, Dresden's running around doing them all the time. And there's no real way he can know it."
Karen was silent for several seconds, digesting that. Then she said,
"Bottom line?
The more he leans on this gift," Butters said, and I could picture him making air quotes, "the more he tears himself to shreds. His body heals remarkably, but he's still human. He's got limits somewhere. And if he keeps this up, he's going to find them."
"What do you think will happen?"
Butters made a thoughtful sound.
"Think about a football player or boxer who has it hard and breaks down in his early 30s because he's just taken too damn much punishment. That's Dresden if he keeps this up."
"I'm sure that once we explain that to him, he'll retire to a job as a librarian," Karen said. Butters snorted.
"It's possible that other things in his system are being affected the same way," he said. "Testosterone production, for example, any number of other hormones, which might be influencing his perception and judgment. I'm not sure he's actually got any more real power at all. I think it just feels that way to him."
"This is fact or theory?"
"An informed theory," he said. "Bob helped me develop it."
Son of a bitch. I kept quiet and thought about that one for a minute.
Could that be true?
Or at least more true than it wasn't?
It would be consistent with the other deal I'd worked out with a fairy,
My godmother Leah had made a bargain to give me the power to defeat my old mentor, Justin DeMorn. Then she'd tortured me for a while, assuring me that it would give me strength. It did, though mostly in retrospect, because I had believed it had. Had I been magic-feathered by a fairy again? And yet, at the end of the day, I could lift a freaking car. Sure you can, Harry, but at what price? No wonder the Winter Knights stayed in the job until they died. If Butters was right, they would have been plunged into the crippling agony of their battered bodies the moment the mantle was taken from them. Sort of the same way I had just been rendered into agonized jello when the Janosqua had shoved a nail into me. I worry, Butters said quietly, that he's changing, that he doesn't know it. Look who's talking, Karen said. Batman. That was one time, Butters said. Karen didn't say anything. All right, Butters relented. A few times. But it wasn't enough to keep those kids from being carried off. You pulled some of them out, Waldo, Karen said. Believe me, that's a win. Most of the time you can't even do that much. But you're missing my point. What point? Ever since you've had the skull, you've been changing too, Karen said. You work hand in hand with a supernatural being that can scare the crap out of me. You can do things you couldn't do before. You know things you didn't know before. Your personality has changed. There was a pause. It has? You're more serious, she said. More intense, I suppose. Yeah, now that I know more about what's really happening out there. It's not something influencing me. Unless it is, and you just don't know it, Karen said. I've got the same evidence on you that you have on Dresden. Butters sighed. I see what you did there. I don't think you do, she said. It's about choices, Waldo. About faith. You have an array of facts in front of you that can fit any of several truths. You have to choose what you're going to allow to drive your decisions about how to deal with those facts. What do you mean? You could let fear be what motivates you, Karen said. Maybe you're right. Maybe Dresden is being turned into a monster against his knowledge and will. Maybe one day he'll be something that kills us all. You're not wrong. That kind of thing can happen. It scares me, too. Then why are you arguing with me? Karen paused for a time before answering. Because fear is a terrible, insidious thing, Waldo. It taints and stains everything it touches. If you let fear start driving some of your decisions, sooner or later it will drive them all. I decided that I'm not going to be the kind of person who lives her life in fear of her friends turning into monsters. What, just like that? It took me a long, long time to get there, she said. But at the end of the day, I would rather have faith in the people I care about than allow my fears to change them, in my own eyes, if nowhere else. I guess maybe you don't see what's happening with Harry here. What? Butters asked. This is what it looks like when someone's fighting for his soul, she said. He needs his friends to believe in him. The fastest way for us to help make him into a monster is to look at him like he is one. Butters was quiet for a long time. I'm going to say this once, Waldo, she said. I want you to listen. Okay? You need to decide which side of the road you're going to walk on, she said gently. Turn aside from your fears, or grab onto them and run with them. But you need to make the call. You keep trying to walk down the middle, you're going to get yourself torn apart. Butters's voice turned bitter. Them or us, choose a side. It's not about taking sides, Karen said. It's about knowing yourself. About understanding why you make the choices you do. Once you know that, you know where to walk, too. The floorboards creaked. Maybe she'd stepped closer to him. I could picture her putting her hand on his arm. You're a good man, Waldo. I like you. I respect you. I think you'll figure it out. A long silence followed. Andy's waiting on me to eat, he said. I'd better get going. Okay, Karen said. Thank you again.
Yeah, sure. Footsteps. The front door opened and closed. A car started up and then drove away. I sat up in bed and fumbled until I found Karen's bedside lamp with my right hand. The light hurt my eyes. My head felt funny, probably the result of being bounced off of walls. I'd lost my shirt again. Butters had added some more bandages and the sharp scent of more antibiotics to my collection of medical trophies. My arm had been bandaged again inside its aluminum brace, and the brace was held in a sling tied around my neck. I got out of bed and wobbled for a minute and then shambled across the floor to the bedroom door. Karen opened it just as I got there and stood looking up at me, her expression worried. "God, you are turning into a monster," she said. "A mummy, one bit at a time." "I'm fine," I said. "Ish." She pursed her lips and shook her head. "How much of that did you hear?" "Everything, after his usual, I'm not really a physician," disclaimer. Her mouth twitched. He's worried, that's all." "I get it," I said. "I think you handled it right." That drew a sparkle from her eyes. "I know I did." "Batman?" I asked. "He's been," she folded her arms, "Ewing, I suppose. With you gone from the city and Molly gone, the streets haven't been getting any safer. Marcone's crowd have taken up the fight against the Fomor whenever their territory is threatened, but their protection costs. Not everyone can afford it." I grimaced. "Damn it," I muttered. "Damn, Mab. I could have been back here months and months ago." "Waldo does what he can. And because he has the skull, that's more than most." "Bob was never meant to be used in the field," I said. "He's a valuable resource until he attracts attention to himself. Once he's been identified, he can be countered or stolen, and then the bad guys get that much stronger. That's why I tried not to take him out of the lab." "The Fomor started taking children last Halloween," Karen said simply. "6-year-olds, right off the streets." I grimaced and looked down from her steady gaze. "We'll sort something out," Karen said. "You hungry?" "Starving," I said. "Come on." I followed her to the kitchen. She took a pair of Pizza Express pizzas from the oven, where she'd had them staying warm. They had almost settled onto the table before I started eating, ravenous. The pizza was my favorite. Not good, but my favorite, because it had been the only pizza I could afford for a long, long time, and I was used to it. Heavy on the sauce, light on the cheese, and the meat was just hinted at, but the crust was thick and hot and flaky and filled with delicious things that murdered you slowly. "Present for you," Karen said.
"Mm-hmm,"
I asked. She plopped a file folder down on the table beside me and said, "From Paranoid Gary, the Paranetison." I swallowed a mouthful and delayed getting another long enough to ask, "The one who found the deal with the boats last year? Crazy but not wrong guy?" "That's him," she said.
"Huh,"
I said, chewing. I opened the folder and started flipping through printed pages of fuzzy images.
"Those are from Iran," Karen said. "Gary says that they show a functioning nuclear power plant."
The images were obviously of some sort of installation, but I couldn't tell anything beyond that.
"Thought they had big old towers."
"He says they're buried in that hill behind the building," Karen said. "Check out the last few images." On the last pages of the folder, things in the installation had changed. Columns of black, greasy smoke rolled out from multiple buildings. In another image, the bodies of soldiers lay on the ground. And in the last image, up on the hillside, which was wreathed in white mist or maybe steam, 3 figures faced one another. One was a large man dressed in a long overcoat and wielding a slightly curved sword in one hand, an old cavalry saber. He carried what might have been a sawed-off shotgun in the other. His skin was dark, and though his head hadn't been shaved like that last time I'd seen him, it could really have been only one person.
"Sonya," I said.
The world's only Knight of the Cross was standing across from 2 blurry figures. Both were in motion, as if charging toward him.
One was approximately the same size and shape as a large gorilla. The other was covered in a thick layer of feathers that gave an otherwise humanoid shape an odd, shaggy appearance. Magog and shaggy feathers, I muttered. Hell's bells, those coins are slippery. When were these taken? Less than 6 hours ago, Karen said, according to paranoid Gary. The Denarians are up to something. Yeah, I said. Deirdre said that Tessa was supposed to be in Iran. That makes sense. In what way does that make sense? Nicodemus wants to pull a job over here, I said. He knows there's only one knight running around, so he sends Tessa and her crew to the other side of the world to stir up major league trouble. Let's say Gary's right, and Iran has a nuclear reactor running, and something goes horribly wrong with it. You've got an instant regional and international crisis. Of course a knight gets sent to deal with it, where he can't get to Chicago, or at least not in time to do any good. Karen took that in silently, and I went back to eating. So you're saying we're on our own, and the bad guys keep stacking up higher and higher, I said. The Janoskwa, you mean, Karen said. Yeah, she shuddered. That thing. Seriously? A Bigfoot? Some kind of mutant serial killer Bigfoot, maybe, I said. Not like one of the regular forest people at all. I can't believe it, Karen said. It's no weirder than any number of... Not that, she said. I can't believe you met a Bigfoot and you never told me about it. I mean, they're famous. They're kind of a private bunch, I said. Did a few jobs for one a few years back named River Shoulders. Liked him. Kept my mouth shut. She nodded, understanding. Then she got up and left the kitchen and came back a moment later with her rocket launcher and an oversized pistol case. She set the rocket launcher down and said, "This will take out something Bigfoot-sized, no problem." I opened my mouth and then closed it again. "Yeah," I admitted. "Okay." She gave me a nod that did not quite include the phrase, "I told you so." "I like to be sure I've got enough firepower to cover any given situation." She put the case on the table and slid it over to me. "And this is for you." I took the case and opened it a little awkwardly, using mostly one hand. In it was a stubby-looking pistol that had been built with a whole hell of a lot of metal, to the point where it somehow reminded me of a steroid-using weightlifter's gargoylish build. The damn thing could have been mounted on a small armored vehicle turret. There were a number of rounds stored with it, each the size of my thumb. "What the hell is this?" I asked, beaming. "Smith & Wesson 500," she said. "Short barrel, but that round is made for taking on big game. Big Gray and Ugly comes at you to make another friendly point. I want you to give him a 400-grain bullet point reply." I whistled, hefting the gun and admiring the sheer mass of it. "I've got one broken wrist already, and you give me this?" "Ride the recoil, Nancy," she said. "You can handle it." She reached out and put her hand on the fingers of my left hand protruding from the sling. "We'll handle it. We'll get this thing with Nicodemus done and get that parasite out of your head. You'll see." "Yeah," I said. "We've got a problem there." "What's that?" "We can't kill the parasite," I said. "We have to save it." Karen gave me a flat look and, after a brief pause, said, "What?" Look, it's not what I thought it was. My condition isn't what we thought it was either." She eyed me carefully. "No, then what is your condition exactly?" I told her. "Come on," I said. "Get up." She sat on the floor, rocking back and forth helplessly with laughter. Her plate, with its slice of pizza, had landed beside her when she'd fallen out of her chair a few minutes before and hadn't moved. "Stop it," she gasped. "Stop making me laugh." I was getting a little annoyed now, as well as embarrassed. My face felt as though it had a mild sunburn. "Damn it, Karen, we're supposed to be back at the slaughterhouse in 20 minutes. Come on, it's just not that funny." "The look," she panted, giggling helplessly. "On your face." I sighed and muttered under my breath and waited for her to recover. It took her only a couple more minutes, though she drifted back into titters several times before she finally picked herself up off the floor. "Are you quite finished?" I asked her, trying for a little dignity. She dissolved into hiccuping giggles again instantly. It was highly unprofessional. Chapter 25. By the time we got back to the slaughterhouse, the sun had gone down, and the night had come on, cold and murky. Rain had begun to fall in the fine mist, and the temperature had dropped enough that I could see it starting to coat the city in a fine sheet of ice. "Ice storm," Karen noted as she parked the car. "Perfect. At least it'll keep people in," I said. "Depending on how this goes, that might cut down on innocent bystanders," she said. "Is Mab messing with the weather again?" I squinted out at the weather. "No," I said, immediately and instinctively certain of the answer. "This is just winter in Chicago being winter in Chicago. Mab doesn't care about innocent bystanders." "But she might care about giving you an advantage," I snorted and said. "Mab helps those who help themselves." Karen gave me a thin smile. "That thing you did with the Janoskwa, you threw magic at it." "Yep. It didn't work, I guess." "Nope," I said. "I hit him with my best shot, something Mab gave me. Just drained off him, grounded out." "Grounded," she said. "Like with a lightning rod?" "Exactly like that," I said. "The forest people know magic, and they're ridiculously powerful, but they understand it differently than humans do. The one I knew used water magic like nothing I'd ever seen or heard of before. This Janoskwa, I think he's using earth magic the same way, on a level I don't know a damn thing about."
"Pretend I don't know a damn thing about earth magic either," Karen said, "and bottom line it for me."
"I threw the most potent battle magic I know at him, and he shut it down with zero trouble. I'm pretty sure he'll be able to do it as much as he wants."
"He's immune to magic?" Karen asked.
I shrugged. "If he senses it coming and can take action, pretty much," I said.
"Which makes me think that he's not all that bright."
"Hell of a secret to give away when his goal wasn't to actually kill you."
"No kidding," I said. "Maybe he gave me too much credit and assumed I already knew.
Either way, I know now."
"Right," Karen said, "which gives you an advantage. You won't bother trying to blast him with magic the next time."
I shuddered, thinking of the creature's sheer speed and power, and of exactly how little he feared me. I touched the handle of my new revolver, now loaded, and in my duster pocket. "With any luck, there won't be a next time." Karen turned to me abruptly, her expression earnest.
"Harry," she said quietly, "that thing means to kill you. I know what it looks like. Don't kid yourself."
I grimaced and looked away. Satisfied that she'd made her point, she nodded and got out of the car. She'd slung one of her space guns, she'd called it a Chris, on a harness under her coat, and you almost couldn't see it when she moved. She rolled around to the trunk, looked up and down the street once, and then took out the rocket launcher and slung it over her shoulder. In the dark, in the rain, it looked like it might have been one of those protective tubes that artists use, maybe 3.5 feet long.
"Really think you can hit him with that thing?" I asked. "It's weapon enough to handle him," she said, "if I have to."
I squinted up at the drizzling mist and said, "I'm getting tired of this job."
"Let's get it done then," Karen said.
This time, when we rolled in, Jordan wasn't on duty. Maybe he'd been given a shift off to get some sleep. Or maybe Nicodemus was so sure I was about to break through his conditioning and suborn him that he'd move the kid to a less vulnerable post. Yeah, that was probably it. When we came in, most of the crew was already downstairs, gathered around the conference table. Even the Janoskwa was standing around in plain sight, albeit in a deep patch of shadow that reduced his visible presence to an enormous furry shadow. Only Nicodemus and Deirdre were absent, and I spotted Deirdre standing silently on one of the catwalks, looking down at the table where Binder was telling some sort of animated anecdote or joke. She looked disturbed. Don't get me wrong. A girl who goes around biting the tongues out of men's mouths is disturbed one way or another, But the Denarian killer looked genuinely troubled or distressed or something. Karen caught me looking at her and sighed.
We can't afford another damsel, Dresden.
I wasn't thinking that, I said.
Sure you weren't.
Actually, I said, I was thinking she looked vulnerable. Might be a good time to confront her about how Harvey died.
Karen clucked her tongue thoughtfully.
I'll be at the table.
Yeah.
She descended the stairs, and I ambled out along the catwalk to stand beside Deirdre. She looked up at me as I approached, her eyes flat, but then her gaze shifted back to the room below.
And then I said,
Binder snickered, evidently coming to the punchline,
why did you wear it then?
Hannah Asher burst out in a short, hearty belly laugh and was joined, more quietly, by Anna Valmont. Even Gray smiled, at least a little. The expression looked somehow alien on his oddly unremarkable features. Deirdre stared down at them all, her expression dispassionate, like a scientist observing bacteria. Her eyes flickered toward me for a second as I approached, her body tensing slightly. Being a genius interrogator, I asked her,
so, why'd you kill Harvey?
She looked at me for a few seconds, then turned her eyes back to the room below to watch Karen come to the table. There was a moment of silence from everyone as they took in her armament. Then Gray rose, suddenly dapper, and offered to help her with the rocket launcher like it was a coat. Karen led him, giving him an edged smile that she directed past him, to the shadows where the Janosqua lurked.
I didn't kill the accountant, she said quietly. Nicodemus said not to.
That surprised me a little. If she wanted to hide herself from me, she didn't need to go to the effort of lying. All she had to do was stay silent. He said that to all of us, I said. Maybe he said something else to you privately.
He didn't, she said. My mother killed him with a spell she calls the Sanguine Scalpel.
The cuts looked a lot like the ones you would inflict, I said.
A cutthroat is a cutthroat, wizard.
Tough to argue with that one. And you chased her.
I went to say... to talk to her, yes.
What did she have to say?
Personal things,
Deirdre replied. I narrowed my eyes. Something wasn't jiving here. Deirdre was demonstrating absolutely no emotion about her mother, which, in my experience, is the next best thing to impossible for almost anyone. Hell, even Maeve had carried enormous mother issues around with her. If Tessa was really trying to beat Nicodemus and Deirdre to the Holy Grail, there should have been something there. Frustration, irritation, fear, anger, resignation, something. Not this distant, cool clarity. Tessa wasn't after any grail. But what else could motivate her? Deirdre looked up from below and studied me calmly.
He knows that you mean to betray him, you know.
Makes us even, I said.
No, it doesn't, she said in that same distant voice. Not even close. I've seen him disassemble men and women more formidable than you dozens of times. You don't have a chance of tricking him, outplanning him, or beating him.
She stated it as a simple fact.
Mab knows it, too.
Then why would she send me?
She's disposing of you without angering your allies at her. Surely you can't be so deluded that you don't see that.
A slow chill went through me at the words. That could make a great deal of sense, actually. If Mab had decided not to use me after all, then my presence was no longer needed. But enough people thought well of me that they could prove extremely trying for her, should they set out to seek revenge. Of course, that wasn't how Mab played the game. When she set something up, she did it so that no matter what happened, she would run the table in the end. Mab probably intended me to do exactly what she told me she sent me to do. But what she hadn't said was that she'd set it up so that it wouldn't hurt her too badly if I failed. If I was too incompetent to work her will, she would regard me as a liability to be dispensed with, preferably without angering my allies. Nicodemus would get the vengeance-level blame for my death if I failed, and Mab would be free and clear to choose a new knight. I felt my jaw tightening and loosening. Well, I couldn't really have expected anything else. Mab struck me as the kind of mother who taught her children to swim by throwing them into the lake. My entire career with her would be shaped the same way, sink or swim. "We'll see," I said. She smiled very slightly and turned back to regard the table below. Gray was sitting with Karen, speaking quietly, a smile on his face. She had her narrow-eyed expression on hers, but a smile also lurked somewhere inside it. He was being amusing. Jerk.
"Is there anything else you'd like to ask me?"
Deirdre asked.
"Yeah," I said, quietly.
"Why? Why what?"
I gestured around. "Why this? Why do you do what you do? Why bite out the tongues and murder hirelings and whatnot? What makes a person do something like this?" She fell silent. The weight of it became oppressive.
"Tell me, child," she said. "What is the longest-lasting relationship in your life?"
I said, "like in terms of when it started or how long it continued?"
"Whichever."
"My mentor in the White Council, maybe," I said. "I've known him since I was 16.
"You see him daily? You speak to him? Work with him?"
"Well, no."
"Ah," she said. "Someone that close to you, who shares your life with you."
I said, "a girlfriend or two. My cat." A small smirk touched her mouth.
"Temporary mates and a cat. One cat."
"He's an awesome cat."
"What you are telling me," she said, "is that you have never shared your life with another over the long term. The closest you have come to it is providing a home and affection for a being which is entirely your subject and in your control."
"Well, not at bath time." The joke did not register on her.
"You have nothing but firefly relationships, there and then gone. I have watched empires rise and fall and rise again beside Nicodemus. You call him my father, but there are no words for what we are. How can there be? Mortal words cannot possibly encompass something which mortals can never embrace and know. Centuries of faith, of cooperation, of trust, working and living and fighting side by side."
Her mouth twisted into a sneer.
"You know nothing of commitment, wizard child. And so I cannot possibly explain to you why I do what I do."
"And what is it that you think you're doing with him exactly?" I asked her.
"We," she said with perfect sincerity, "are fighting to save the world."
Which, if true, was about the creepiest thing I'd run into that day. "From what?" I asked. She smiled very faintly and finally fell silent. I didn't press. I didn't want to hear anything else from her anyway. I withdrew and went down to the table with the others. "Dinner," Gray was saying. "Assuming we're all alive and filthy rich afterward, I mean." "I certainly can say no," Karen replied, her tone light with banter. "You're a little creepy, Gray." "Goodman," Gray said. "Say with me, good man."
"I was a cop for 20 years, Gray," Karen said. "I can recognize a fake name when I hear it."
I settled down next to Karen and pulled the new revolver out of my pocket, put it on the conference table right next to where I could reach it, and said to Gray,
"Hi."
Gray eyed me and then the gun. Then he said to Karen, "Does he make these kinds of calls for you?"
"You'll have to try a little harder with something a little less obvious than that," Karen said. "Honestly, I'm sort of hoping he shoots you a little. I've never seen a round from that beast hit somebody."
Gray settled back in his seat, eyeing me sourly. "Bro," he said, "you're totally cock-blocking me." In answer, I picked up the monster revolver.
"No," I said. Then I freaking cocked it, drawing the hammer back with my thumb.
Rather than a mere click, it made a sinister ratcheting sound.
"Now I'm cock-blocking you."
The table got completely quiet and still. Anna Valmont's eyes were huge.
"Touché,"
Gray said, nodding slightly.
"Well, there was no harm in my asking the lady, was there?"
"None to her," I agreed amiably. "Murphy, should I shoot him anyway?"
Karen put a finger to her lips and tapped thoughtfully.
I've got to admit, I'm curious as hell. But it seems a little unprofessional, as long as he backs off.
Hear that? I asked Gray.
You people are savages, Gray said.
He shook his head, muttered something beneath his breath, and rose.